thank you very much for that kind introduction, and thank you for inviting me here to the University of Chicago. It is really an honor, and I know events like this are harder to organize than they look, and so I appreciate such a well-organized event. So this sort of variant of what I'm going to talk about tonight is obviously related to my book, but sort of thinking about U.S. foreign policy over the last 4 or 5 years. And I'm plagued by this question of the state. I have been critiquing the state, but now I find myself increasingly defending the state as an entity to be taken seriously, if nothing else. And I'm interested in how it is that American foreign policy has gone during the Cold War from producing client states or trying to produce client states to inadvertently or otherwise producing failed states, a series of failed states, one after the other. So this is part of what drove my research in terms of Tropic of Chaos. But I'll just begin with a sort of a summary of the thesis of the book. So for those of you who have not read any of it, in the book I argue that climate change is already a driver of violence. And the book was an attempt to essentially intervene in a conversation that began at the end of the Cold War with the rise of the first failed state, Somalia, and maybe you could say the kickoff point was Robert Kaplan's article and then book, The Coming Anarchy. And the whole problem of state failure has really been the domain of the right. And many people on the left, broadly defined, have simply decided that this is a right-wing category, that you should not use failed states as a category, and that is because this concept is used to justify humanitarian intervention. But that, I don't think, is sufficient. Just because an idea is misused or used for, intentionally used for purposes that one might oppose, doesn't necessarily mean that you have sufficiently dismissed the idea intellectually. And I think state failure is very, very serious, and this came to me as a journalist. And state failure, failed states, are kind of like art or pornography, right? There's that famous quote from some Supreme Court justice when they asking, well, how do you know what pornography is? You know it when you see it. Well, you know what state failure is when you see it, too. And there's nothing progressive about it. A society where drug-addled teenagers with guns run checkpoints on the road is not a society in which there is space for progressive civilian politics. And that's part of why you don't see those kinds of movements in places like Somalia, Cote d'Ivoire. So it's a very serious problem, I think, for the left to deal with. So the argument of the book is that climate change is already causing violence by interacting with two previously existing crises. The previously existing crisis of Cold War militarism, which the legacy of which was to litter much of the planet, particularly the global south, with cheap weapons and networks of men, almost exclusively men, who know how to use these weapons and are trained in the arts of asymmetrical warfare. And though the Cold War ideology that motivated these guerrillas and counterinsurgents might have changed or gone away, the networks still remain and many of the practices still remain. The other pre-existing crisis that climate change, by which I mean the extreme weather that is the expression of climate change, droughts, floods, etc., is interacting with to exacerbate and create violence, is the legacy of neoliberalism, neoliberal economic restructuring, as pushed on the economies of the global south for the last 35 years or so by the Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF and the World Bank, that have, since the Latin American debt crisis of the 1980s, been systematically forcing distressed economies, the states of distressed economies, to privatize state-owned assets, deregulate their markets, open their economies to foreign investment, and let that foreign investment come and go at will, and to impose drastic austerity on all sorts of social spending, from education and healthcare to veterinary extension programs, so that the effect of these policies over the last 30 years has been to reduce many states in the global south to hollowed out, corrupt former shells of their former selves. So then, Climate change comes along to a place like Kenya, where I begin the book, in having the effect of, while there's actually, over the last 30 years, there's been an overall increase in the level of precipitation annually in Kenya, the experience on the drought, on the ground more often than not, is drought, because the rains are coming all at once at the wrong time, and then the water rushes away, taking with it topsoil, and so the actual experience is just desiccation and drought. So people turn to the state for assistance, and there's nothing there. The state really doesn't have the capacity to help people adapt to climate change. And so the watchwords in the climate discussion are mitigation and adaptation. Mitigation means reducing greenhouse gas emissions to mitigate the problem. Adaptation means both the social and physical adaptation to the changes that are coming down the pike, the changes that we're already locked in for. So in terms of adaptation, farmers, pastoralists turn to the state, and it's not there. It simply doesn't have the capacity to help them. Well, how do they adapt? Well, if the landscape is flooded with cheap weaponry, more often than not, people will pick up the gun, and they'll turn against their neighbor to steal their cattle, or they'll follow some millenarian leader who promises them deliverance through capturing the state, or whatever it might be. And I call this combination of the onset of climate change and the legacy of neoliberal restructuring and the legacy of Cold War militarism, the catastrophic convergence. And this plays out differently in different places around the planet. It's not always some sort of even split that the crisis in some country is, you know, one-third the result of the Cold War, one-third the result of neoliberalism, one-third climate change. In Mexico, there really isn't a huge legacy from Cold War militarism. There were some guerrilla movements in Oaxaca. There was, you know, repression. There was the massacre in 68. But the society wasn't totally traumatized the way Afghanistan was by the Cold War. The real thing that has driven violence in northern Mexico is more NAFTA and neoliberal economic restructuring, and just the stripping away of the progressive features of the Mexican state. Mexico had the first officially socialist constitution, essentially socialist. It's 1919 constitution. Article 26 made very clear that everything in the country belonged to the state, down to the rock salt and the water. And that was undone by NAFTA, and so too went the protections for the ejido system, which was a form of collective land ownership that came out of the revolution that protected about 2 million peasants before NAFTA went into effect. So people have been pushed off the land primarily by neoliberalism. And there's some, you know, surplus weaponry from the days of Cold War violence, but that's not really the main thing. It is the onset of climate change, failure of fisheries, the failure of crops, that is driving violence there. Whereas in a place like Afghanistan, there's really not much of a history of neoliberal economic restructuring. The real trauma there is the effect of the Cold War. Afghanistan was a buffer state. It was a battleground between the Soviet Union and the Afghan communist government and the Mujahideen forces, who were supported by the Pakistani intelligence and funded by Saudi Arabia and the U.S. And that war that lasted from the communist coup d'etat happens in 78, the Soviet intervention happens in 79, and in 79 the U.S. is immediately supporting the Afghan Mujahideen. The U.S. poured $4 billion into that struggle. The Saudis matched that money. This helped the ISI, the Pakistani spy agency, balloon into what it is now. And that is what has torn to piece the social fabric of Afghanistan. It's not the privatization of state industries, et cetera, et cetera. So the catastrophic convergence plays out differently in different places. So the thing I've been thinking about in terms of the last several years is, what is it that is causing U.S. foreign policy to produce failed states? We've produced a failed state inadvertently in Afghanistan that, you know, begins in the early 80s, as I just said. We've produced a failed state in Iraq. We're now producing a failed state in Syria. We have helped produce a failed state in Libya. We're helping to produce a failed state in Yemen. Why is this happening? And I think that some of it has to do, I'll give you essentially the punchline first, and I'll get back to it at the end. I think some of it has to do with the collapse of the U.S. ruling class as a kind of coherent class for itself, right? Marx talks about class consciousness and the working class developing class consciousness through class struggle. The working class is a class in itself because of its relationship to the means of production. It does not own the means of production, right? But it becomes a class for itself through class struggle. Well, so too the ruling class, right? What makes the ruling class, and we could debate and say, what is a ruling class? Is a ruling class? By this I mean, you know, political and economic elites who make the key decisions in the society. What is it that gives that group or those networks coherence to operate with unity and vision? And I think it is essentially the same thing. Class struggle. Threats from outside. During the Cold War, U.S. elites faced opposition at home, domestic opposition from the left, and internationally. They faced opposition from the Soviet Union and its allies, from various left social democratic movements, from sort of left nationalist movements, from various guerrilla movements. And these threats caused the American elite, the policy elite, the ruling class, to rally the wagons and plan. It was in response to Sputnik that the U.S. passes the Defense Education Bill, I forget the exact name of it, the legislation that pushes enormous amounts of money into the university system. This was a part of a long-term strategy to make capitalism at a global scale look better than the alternatives. You have this logic crystallized in the kitchen debate between Nixon, then Vice President Nixon, and Premier Khrushchev, where Nixon is taking Khrushchev through a kitchen, a typical American kitchen on a television show and saying, do Soviet housewives have this? So that was part of the logic of the Cold War, was to actually achieve capitalist development and to try and create client states to try and stave off the threat of a good example. It wasn't only that, though. Lest you think I'm naive and romanticizing the past, the U.S. during the Cold War also used extremely violent methods, right? Just think about the Greek Civil War, right, at the end of World War II, from 47 to 49, where the British sort of begin this. They convince the Greek communist partisans to disarm and then allow the Greek, essentially, fascists. They were not allied with the Axis powers. They were allied with the West, but it was the Metaxas regime was essentially a fascist regime. They allow those forces and Greeks who had collaborated with the Nazis to rearm and start hunting down these communist partisans. This is a British project. The U.S. picks it up when the British are essentially run out of money. Tens of thousands are tortured and killed. I mean, we could go on and on with these examples, right? Think about then Indonesia, the CIA's role in helping round up one of the largest communist parties in Asia and have them slaughtered. I mean, the Indonesian forces do it, but the U.S. CIA is helping in terms of passing information. The Vietnam War, Greece again, the Colonel's coup of 68 to 74 that had among its leadership people who had been on the CIA payroll. So I'm not saying that during the Cold War, U.S. foreign policy was just this big effort to like develop other people's economies and shame socialists by looking really good. There was also lots and lots of violence. But the violence had a different pattern. The violence was about creating client states. And it's not even that the death toll now is greater, but the pattern now really seems to be of creating failed states. The strategy during the Cold War was to destroy the left. Don't destroy the state itself and the society. Now, the U.S. is again and again involved in adventures where it is actually the state itself and the society of Libya or Syria that disintegrates. So I think that has to do with the fact that the threat of a good example, in part, has made it okay for these things to happen. It's not that U.S. policy elites set out to do this, but they don't police their policies to make sure as to prevent that, because the consequences just aren't as significant. The other factor in this is, which sort of predates the end of the Cold War, and I mean, the point is, what I'm saying is that, so when the Cold War ends, that the external threat goes away, and at the same time, there's been a whole series of victories domestically over progressive forces. And that begins somewhat earlier, and that is rooted in the profit crisis of the 1970s and the collapse of the Keynesian model at a global scale, domestically and internationally. And in a nutshell, what happens, you know, the Great Depression has the U.S. economy on its knees. 25% of the workforce is thrown out into the street. All of the old stabilizing methods of the 1920s, like welfare capitalism, that's done away with. The ruling class, the industrialists, the policy planning elite, are really in disarray. Massive movements like the Bonus March and then the Congress of Industrial Organizations are rising, pressuring. You've got Huey Long in Louisiana, kind of left populist. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who is I don't necessarily subscribe to the great man theory of history, but I do think that personalities really do matter. And here's this hard-drinking, chain-smoking, disabled aristocrat who's like, whatever, the elites don't like my policies, I'm going to save them from themselves. He actually says, I welcome their wrath. And he imposes the New Deal. And from there, through the war on poverty, then, of course, World War II is the ultimate sort of Keynesian experiment with, you know, massive government intervention in the economy. And the policies of the New Deal are at first experimental and somewhat haphazard. The first conversation that Keynes and FDR have, FDR says to one of his aides afterwards, he says, that John Maynard Keynes must be some sort of a mathematician, not a political economist. He gave me a whole rigmarole of numbers. And Keynes was there to say, look, you can't balance the budget and extend government spending. You have to do deficit spending. Don't worry about the debts. You want to do countercyclical deficit spending. Read what I've written, which FDR had not read Keynes and was not, you know, playing from the Keynes literature. He was sort of feeling his way through it. But Keynes's ideas become the ruling ideas of the kind of Atlantic capitalist planning elites, and this works for a long time. World War II is the militarization of this model, but it lifts the U.S. definitively and finally out of the Depression. The rebuilding of the sort of two other cores of the capitalist economy, Japan and Europe, was a example of Keynesianism on a global scale. The U.S. Marshall Plan stimulates all of this demand and redevelopment, and there was a debate about that, right? There was the Morgenthau Plan was proposed by Henry Morgenthau, who said, well, he wanted to pastoralize Germany. He said, well, these people just keep starting wars. Maybe they shouldn't have factories to build bombs with. Maybe we should turn them into an agricultural country. And that was deemed to be too provocative and dangerous because, of course, half of Germany was controlled by the USSR. Half of, you know, Europe, Central Europe, was controlled by the USSR. And there was the question of whether or not this other camp would outshine the U.S. And that's, you know, kind of hard for us Americans to get our minds around this, but there's a great book by Francis Stoner Saunders that captures the cultural side of this stuff, where, you know, the struggle for the hearts and minds of European intellectuals was a crucial part of this. And they, at least, saw the Soviet model and said, well, you know, that's the system that managed to industrialize and killed most of the German soldiers. And, I mean, okay, then later crimes come out, some people knew about it, some people overlooked it, but they're like, at least it functioned as at a certain, like, industrial and political level. So the U.S. does not follow Morgenthau's plan to pastoralize Germany, obviously. And the recovery of the building out the devastation from World War II is the basis for the long boom, the golden era of capitalism. The war not only killed millions of people, it destroyed billions of dollars worth of wealth. And the process of rebuilding that meant that in the U.S., there could be high rates of growth, rising wages, high taxes, and still very healthy profits. That model seems like it would go on indefinitely. Finally, by the late 60s, the global economy has definitively recovered from World War II, and new industrial powers are beginning to come on the scene. And world markets are glutted. There's finally too much stuff and not enough people with money to buy it all. And profit rates, after-tax profit rates, begin to decline precipitously in the U.S. And you have, at the beginning of the 1970s, Nixon, when answering a journalist's question about why he was experimenting with a guaranteed income in Indiana, saying, the journalist says, isn't that rather Keynesian? And you're a conservative Republican. He says, we're all Keynesians now. By the end of the decade, you have Jimmy Carter introducing the hallmark policies that will be Reaganomics. He deregulates trucking, airlines, and telecommunications. I believe those were the ones he did. What explains that is this profit collapse. The nadir of the sort of after average tax profits was around 1973. And it was in response to that that planning elites shifted away from the ideas of Keynes to the ideas of Hayek and Friedman, who were the neoclassical economists who, beginning in the 1930s, had Hayek leading the way, had been lamenting the rise of collectivism and the decline of free markets. And they had waited patiently with funding from people like the father of the Koch brothers and others in this new kind of right-wing think tank movement. And it was only when there was this crisis in the 1970s, a crisis of profitability that was also expressed as stagflation, that their ideas were finally taken up by planning elites. And what stagflation was for the first time in American history, you had rising unemployment and inflation. So you had rising wages even as you had rising unemployment. In other words, the Phillips curve was off. And before that, whenever you had increased unemployment, you saw wages cool down. By the late 60s, early 70s, wages were no longer responding to unemployment. Why was that? It was because, in part, the Keynesian model provided too much support for the working class in their struggle. Some of it was direct in terms of laws that were very favorable to organized labor. For example, there was a famous General Electric strike, a strike against General Electric in the late 60s, in which the strikers not only got their strike pay from the union, but were also able to collect welfare. And it was examples like that that made industrialists say, wait a minute, you know, you're taxing us at these exorbitant rates so that you can give it to workers who are striking against us, you give them welfare, the federal government, our taxes are subsidizing workers who go out on strike. This is ridiculous. This doesn't make any sense. And to some extent, there was truth to that. That's part of why the working class was so strong in the 1970s. And you see in the 70s, there's, you know, it's one of the peaks of labor action in the United States. So it's in response to this that Keynes is out, Hayek is in, and you get a shift in domestic policy that's about cutting social welfare, deregulating markets, changing laws to make it harder for unions to organize. This begins slowly in the last 2 years of Carter. It then takes off with vigor under Reagan. Carter appoints Paul Volcker as chairman of the Federal Reserve. And Volcker's job is to break this wage-price spiral. And he does this by plunging the U.S. economy into this what was then the second worst recession since the Great Depression, by restricting the money supply and thereby forcing interest rates up to about 18-19%. So that meant there was very hard for people to borrow, and economic activity constricted radically. At the same time, Reagan then comes in, he stacks the National Labor Relations Board with appointees who are hostile to labor and sends the message that the government is going to be on the side of capital. It's not going to play umpire, it's going to be on the side of capital in this struggle. And the Air Traffic Controllers Union that endorsed Reagan and gave him money, the first example, they go out on strike and he fires about 10,000 of the 11,000 who went out on strike because many of them were directly or indirectly federal employees. And this inaugurates what we now call neoliberalism, right? A different set of policies that are about letting the market handle everything, ultimately. And that really hammers the social movements from the 1960s, organized labor, all that domestic opposition really is thrown back on the back foot and begins to disintegrate in a significant fashion. Then comes the end of the Cold War, Soviet Union collapses, even though many people around the world on the left said, oh, that's good, now we don't have this, you know, example of this police state, and there's going to be this revival of the left. Actually, you know, more people than turning to socialism turned away from it. So, well, that's, even though we didn't like the Soviet Union, that proves that socialism isn't going to work. So you've got this, you know, total collapse of left opposition internationally. The combination of those two things, it seems to me, leads to a process of disintegration within the U.S. ruling class, if you will, the policy and economic elites. No longer do they have to rally the wagons. No longer do they have to think as a class. And so now you see what we have. We don't have an energy policy that works for capitalism. We have an energy policy that works for the fossil fuel industry. We don't have a healthcare policy that works for capitalism, right? I mean, their industrial firms move north across the border to Canada because it saves money to use the socialized healthcare system up there. But we don't socialize those costs here. You know, we have a policy that serves the healthcare industry, and on and on and on. And you see that while neoliberalism has been good for the 1%, the owning class, there from 1979 to 2011, you know, the most people lost their share of income went down, and for the top 10%, their share went up, and for the top 1%, it went up 65%. So the 1% have been doing well under this regime of smash and grab, don't plan, don't think for the whole, don't think long term, just go for the short term, accumulate as much as possible in the short term. And this, I think, plays out in foreign policy similarly. There's no need to worry if things don't work out. So you see this in the example of Iraq. So the Bush administration, you know, inherits a sort of slow war against Iraq from the Clinton administration, from his father and then Clinton. And the invasion of Iraq, famously, as many of you I know are intimately aware, is done under false pretexts, but also, like, with no plan. It is incredible to look back at what they did. They went in there. They put L. Paul Bremer in charge. He didn't speak Arabic. He didn't know anything about Iraq. I mean, it's incredible that they did that. Anyone who spoke out and saying, not from some sort of humanitarian left position, but like technocrats within the government who spoke out and said, hey, this is not going to work. This is going to be a mess. They were sidelined. They were punished. And the plan was to overthrow Saddam and then let market forces take over, and everything was going to be better. And the American trapped inside everybody was going to come out, and all would be well. Then, of course, there was the de-bathification that L. Paul Bremer does. He, you know, fires the top five levels of the Ba'ath Party. So the entire officer class, the most of the technical elites thrown out onto the street, guaranteed to create a resistance. And the whole thing spins out of control. Bremer also wanted to impose a hand-picked government. And this is an important fact that I don't think Americans know enough. He was insisting on a hand-picked government, and it was the Shiite masses who forced the election. And Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who rarely gets involved in politics, on that occasion came out and said, no, we must have elections. And I was there when this happened. Like, suddenly, there were hundreds of thousands of Shiite activists in the street protesting peacefully for elections. And so the Coalitional Provisional Authority, the U.S. occupation and its NATO friends, were forced to hold elections. Foolishly, the Sunni elite who had been thrown out boycott the elections. The resistance has already begun. But they wouldn't have done well in the elections anyway because of the demographics. And lo and behold, what happens? A Shiite-dominated government that ultimately, in the long run, and to this day, is as loyal to Iran as it is to the U.S., but more importantly, is totally corrupt, right? It is a kleptocracy that has not been able to deliver basic law and order or running water or electricity or anything that the people of Iraq need. So when ISIS attacked Mosul on June 10th, 2014. I mean, the reason that the army collapsed was because these generals were people who had purchased those positions so that they could shake people down and sell other positions to other people. And the officer class fled. The ISIS went to Mosul to rob a bank and liberate prisoners. And the Iraqi army, its officer class, disappeared, and then the soldiers, without leadership, took off their clothes and fled, and then ISIS was like, whoa, I guess we're taking over Mosul. In other words, what I'm saying is that this shift in foreign policy is not a plan, and I don't think it's necessarily very rational, but it is rooted in the profit crisis and the shift to neoliberalism, in which also ideologically the state is denigrated. The state is attacked, or certain features of the state, the social democratic, progressive, redistributive features of the state, regulatory features of the state are attacked. Its repressive features are built up. Because, of course, the size, the economic size of the state in most Western, most countries that have undergone core economies that have undergone neoliberal restructuring, the state doesn't get smaller, it just changes form. So instead of a big, robust public housing program, we don't have that anymore. Instead, we've got huge and expensive prisons that are publicly funded. So it's a transfer of population and money into different institutions. It's not an actual reduction of the state, but that's all conducted in the name of reducing the state. So it's this neoliberal set of policies and ideology plus the collapse of the Cold War has led to a sort of just disintegration of the American ruling class's imagination. The only other thing I can think of that allows this to happen is that there is a way in which it is possibly viewed in some sectors as being helpful for blocking China. That might sound crazy. I'm not suggesting there's a conspiracy, but this is how Chinese elites see some of this. They look at these failed states, they look at these policies that lead to state collapse, and they see it in terms of, like, these are physical barriers to Chinese investment. The Chinese going out strategy that begins in 2005 is about sending massive amounts of direct investment abroad. And at first, people were saying, and the Chinese were saying, well, we can work in failed states. We're tough. You know, we know how to do this. Turns out it's not as easy as it looks, and the Chinese have, in fact, been blocked by these things. It's difficult. So that's how Chinese elites see this. And the reason they see it that way is because they see the U.S. trying to block them in other fronts. The U.S. has, you know, repeatedly blocked Chinese trade deals. China is not even in the top 10 foreign direct investors in the U.S., yet it is always the top country that is harassed by the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., which is a section of the Treasury Department. And so you have, like, the examples of a Chinese oil company tried to buy Unocal. That was prevented. Chinese company tried to buy a small server company in Three Leaves. That was blocked because of the underlying system. So it's rarely are these deals actually blocked in terms of officially saying no. What happens is that the Committee on Foreign Investment will investigate and put up hurdles and encourage the firm to sort of back away. And a lot of this stuff is, you know, delicately timed, and so various funders, you know, pull out of these deals. So just investigating companies is often sufficient to get them to back down. And Chinese deals were investigated more than any other company between 2011 and 2013. There were 54 such investigations. One of these actually had to go all the way to Obama, where he said no, and that was a Chinese company wanted to buy 4 wind farms in Oregon, and it was deemed that they were too close to a U.S. military base where drones were tested. But other stuff like this happens where it's always in the guise of national security these investments are shut down. Regardless of what we think of that, Chinese elites see this as, okay, we're being blocked this way. Another front where they see themselves as being blocked is in terms of reforming the Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF and the World Bank. China, India, Russia have been pressuring the U.S. to allow them more say and access to these institutions. And the White House, under Obama, to its credit, agreed that there should be an expansion of funding for the IMF, and that economies like India and China would put in investment for that and thereby have more say. And this would diminish the power of the U.S. to some extent. The U.S. would still have 17% or so, I mean, the dominant share, but it would diminish the say of U.S. allies in Western Europe. And the idea of that was, well, okay, this is here are rising powers, and you can either go toe-to-toe with them, or you can bring them into the systems that were used to control friends in Europe after World War II. And in this argument, I'm relying on the late Peter Gowan, who I think really analyzes best the U.S.-European relationship. He says that, you know, in a nutshell, what he argues is that just because the U.S. and European states are allies doesn't mean the U.S. doesn't bully European states, try to divide them and maintain individualized relationships, try to weaken the EU in certain respects. So to his credit, Obama says, okay, we have to expand these institutions to include these rising powers and give them some say. But it can't get past Congress, because we have this policy elite that no longer has in its imagination or its critical capacities thinking in terms of the larger scale, thinking about like the system, capitalism at a global scale, what it requires to be reproduced, what is the role of the United States in that. And I'm not saying, you know, I don't want to sound like some sort of cheerleader for the State Department here. I'm just saying, like, you know, amorally, like that's what the project used to be. That's what the U.S. was. It was the capitalist state among capitalist states that served U.S. corporate interests, but also acted to reproduce capitalism at a global scale. So, no, they're not going to expand the IMF. Boom, it's done. So what happens? The BRIC bank emerges, and more importantly, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. And now about 50 countries have poured into that. Got to the point where Obama, you know, a month ago, actually rebuked Cameron in the UK for investing in that. So that's, you can see, that's a sign of this class sort of not operating as a class for itself, but just operating as a set of interests. And in Congress, you have these characters who are interested in getting reelected, pandering to their base, and no longer engage in a kind of thinking that was a hallmark of the Cold War. And I'm not, again, you know, I'm not romanticizing the Cold War. It was very bloody. So all of this, to pull it back to climate change, bodes very ill for the future of the planet, because the U.S. is still the largest economy in the world, and it very much sets the agenda in many ways, even if its power is in decline. And the fact that there isn't a constituency that is capable of dealing with the fact that we have to get off fossil fuels as soon as possible, and that even if we do that, best case scenario, we're locked in for very serious climate disruption nonetheless. So thus, we have the U.S. incapable of taking this leadership role, because in part we don't have an energy policy for capitalism at the scale of the U.S. or globally. We have an energy policy for the fossil fuel industry. So that, in a nutshell, is how I've been thinking about the rise of these failed states. It's not that they're planned. I'm not saying that, oh, this is a plan to block China, but that again and again when this happens, and at least like, wow, that didn't work out, so we've got a failed state in Libya, that it's okay because it blocks the rival. And the rival needs, you know, the rival is growing at, I mean, this is the bad year, right? This is the ultimate bad year for China, 7% a year. It's been above 10% a year growth for 20 years. China needs resources, and the U.S. has been, you know, blocking them in Africa, trying to leveraging the Democratic Republic of Congo to threatening them to like turn down Chinese investment. The other thing, I think, the final ingredient that sort of makes this okay, though not planned, is that the oil industry is not, in fact, threatened by lack of oil. The oil industry is threatened, as it always has been, by too much oil. This is Timothy Mitchell's argument in his superb book, Carbon Democracy. The problem for the oil industry for the last 100 years has been the threat of too much oil, glutting markets, collapsing prices. So you could see how, okay, so Libya is sort of offline, Iraq is sort of offline, all these countries are still producing oil, but much less than they were. That's not bad for the oil industry. I mean, oil prices could be much, much lower if all of those countries were functioning states and pumping out as much oil as they could. So it's not that there's a plan to do that, but it's like, man, there's no impetus to really change this because it doesn't really threaten core interests. And how is this going to change? I mean, you know, if once upon a time American elites were capable of giving a little to keep a lot, were capable of embracing reform and redistribution so as to preserve and reproduce their system. They did that because they were threatened, right? They were threatened by social movements at home and abroad. And the only way we're going to get elites in this country to think in anything like the long term is to threaten them with social movements that make serious demands on them. And, you know, that's the heart of what has to happen in terms of climate change. Movements have to pressure the state to move against the fossil fuel industry. I should wrap up and open up for questions soon. But one last not hopeless point about all this. In terms of climate change, the important thing to remember is that we have really all the pieces we need to deal with this, that we have the money, we have the technology, and we even have the laws we need to essentially euthanize the fossil fuel industry. If we euthanize the fossil fuel industry, that is not the same as creating a sustainable society. It simply means that we can buy time to deal with all of these other problems like deforestation, overfishing, the increasing toxicity of the environment. And I have been advocating for a kind of green developmentalism, not because I think that is the best world possible, but because I think it's realistic and doable as a policy, and that we have to think both short-term and long-term, because this climate science is very clear that we don't have a century to deal with this problem, right? We have, at most, a few decades. And I don't think that means that we can wait to transform all social relations and achieve socialism or some other kind of society and political economy to deal with fossil fuels. Nor is the track record of socialist economies necessarily that good in terms of decarbonization. I think decarbonization is something separate. And I think with enough pressure, capitalism could decarbonize. And it would not make it sustainable. It would just buy us enough time to deal with the other problems. Now, what the money, the technology, the laws, the money. The federal government has enormous amounts of money. It's one-third of the state and federal government, one-third of the economy. The government consumes enormous amounts of energy. If the government was pressured to buy electric vehicles and source the electricity for the federal government alone, 450,000 big office buildings with clean energy, that would create a demand on a scale that would then allow the clean tech sector to create economies of scale to lower prices, whereby the clean energy and electric vehicles and other clean tech would be able of competing on the open market just at the price point. The other source of money is that corporate America is sitting on vast amounts of uninvested cash, enormous amounts of uninvested cash. This is not money that's given to shareholders or to managers as bonuses. This is money that is retained by the firms for investment. The last number I read was about like $8 trillion was sort of parked in low-yield government securities waiting for the next big thing, waiting for investment. If policy lined up correctly, all of that money could go into building out the new infrastructure we need. The laws, what are the laws? People have been, you know, I think in the environmental movement, tragically unclear on this. We have the laws we need to essentially shut down the fossil fuel industry, and it is the Clean Air Act of 1970 as modified by the lawsuit in Massachusetts versus EPA. What happened was the Clinton administration signs the Kyoto Protocol, the first treaty that pledges to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The Senate refuses to pass it. It doesn't go into effect. And then some green groups and some states, thus Massachusetts being one of them, sue the EPA, saying, you have to, under the language of the Clean Air Act, you have to regulate greenhouse gas emissions because the Clean Air Act is written such that any smokestack pollutant that is shown by science to be harmful to human health has to be regulated. And they show this is harmful. GHG emissions are harmful to human health. This goes to the Supreme Court 2007. The Roberts Court says yes. The EPA doesn't have the power to, doesn't have the ability to, has the obligation to do this. And we've been waiting for about 20 different tailoring rules to come from this, for limits to be set. The first thing that the Obama administration did, I mean, the Bush administration just ignored the law. The Obama administration said they would follow the law. They did nothing for the first 4 years, essentially. Then they issued some rules for automobiles. But that was actually politically easy because we already have de facto emissions rules for automobiles, which are the gas mileage rules. Then they issued rules for new coal-fired power plants. That was also politically easy because of the fracking revolution. There was so much natural gas coming online that it didn't make sense to build coal plants. Nobody was going to build coal plants anyway. So there wasn't much of a political hit with that. And now we're waiting for them to issue the rulings on existing coal-fired power plants. And unfortunately, a lot of the environmental movement was busy with other stuff, while not all of the environmental movement, should be fair. I mean, but it wasn't, you know, the main thing that people were thinking about. Like, we have to pressure the EPA to bring the hammer down on the fossil fuel industry so as to save civilization from itself. So the laws are in place. We have the money. We have the technology. We've got, you know, distributed solar, the PVC, photovoltaics. The price of that is like dropping like a stone. It's amazing. We've got commercial scale wind and solar. We've got electric vehicles. We've got the grid. It's not like we have to invent or build all this stuff. This, you know, these technologies exist. They need to be scaled up. So the good news is all the key pieces we need to mitigate this disaster and buy time to deal with the many, many other crises we face as a species on this planet are all in place, but we just need, again, that threat, that credible threat to those who make the decisions. We have to pressure elites to do the right thing. And that's where social movements come in. So on that note, I will end my rambling and open it up for your questions. Fire away.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for coming to the University of Chicago. I'm a graduating senior, and I'm interested in pursuing a career in international development. So my question is, how much can we really attribute the creation of failed states, like changes in American political elite? Because even during the Cold War, when they had a credible socialist threat, many of the most influential client states of America, such as Latin American countries like El Salvador and Nicaragua, are today not really considered success states with like really high inequality and really high wage discrepancies. So is it really American elite that changed, or is it just an intervention in general that has failed us?
That's a very good question. I mean, certainly intervention, Cold War intervention is part of what sets the stage for failed states. I mean, that's what I argue with this idea of this catastrophic convergence. But I think that, you know, if you look at economic policy, neoliberalism is one of the key ingredients in this. And the World Bank and the IMF used to do things that by today's standards would be considered downright socialistic, you know, extend low interest loans for state-owned companies to build big dams, okay, when they kill rivers and it's bad. But the point being that the market fundamentalism, which has at its heart this idea that the state must, as Grover Norquist, the tax activist, anti-tax activist, put it, the state must be reduced to the size where it can be drowned in a bathtub. I mean, that's the guiding principle. And you see it clearly in the economic logic that accompanies intervention. But you're right that, you know, this kind of violent military intervention alone is not the only thing that's producing failed states. I think it's the total ensemble of policies that reduce the state and then attack without any consideration about what the long-term consequences are, because there's no threat. I mean, so what? So what? The U.S. created a failed state, helped create a failed state in Afghanistan. The U.S. definitely directly created a failed state in Iraq. So what? Who cares, right? Who's denouncing the U.S. for that? What threats do they face? None, really. So that would be my answer to that.
Hi there. My name is Kenzo. I'm a second year in the college, and I'm a student that works with a student group called the UChicago Climate Action Network, and one of our main campaigns is called the Stop Funding Climate Change campaign, in which we're pressuring our university to divest from fossil fuels. And so I was just hoping to hear some of your thoughts on what you think on fossil fuel divestment as a tactic of social stigmatization.
I support fossil fuel divestment. I criticized the divestment movement early on for making false claims about what divestment would do economically. At first, you know, 350, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, and activists at 350 were saying, this is going to hurt the bottom line of the fossil fuel industry. And that's not true. It doesn't hurt the bottom line of the fossil fuel industry. And to their credit, that's not what the divestment movement says anymore. So, but yeah, I support the divestment movement because it is the movement that is on fire. I mean, I think that around the divestment movement, there's a lot of cheerleading. So I'm going to speak honestly and bluntly and unflatteringly about this for a second. The truth about the brilliance of the divestment movement is that, no offense, students, college students won't get involved if it's not on campus. College students need something on campus, and that's what divestment offers. It's not actually the most logical way to attack this problem. I mean, compared to going after the EPA, which is a direct shot on the pocket, to use a pool metaphor, divestment is the bank shot, right? It's like we attack the university so as to undermine, strip the social license from the fossil fuel industry, an industry that's, you know, ranks at the bottom every year in terms of Pew's survey of the 25 top industries in America. People hate the fossil fuel industry, right? Every day, most Americans see the amount of money, the specific amount of money they're giving to the specific company at the gas pump. They hate the fossil fuel industry. And what the fossil fuel industry uses instead of its social license is its actual license to operate. So there's a kind of symbolism about this that I find frustrating. But I realize that the thing that you can't quite say to students, because it sounds insulting, but as the truth is, like, well, you know, if you went around campus saying, like, let's all go attack the EPA, you're not going to have as much traction as if you say, let's attack the administration. Like, we're involved in this. We're implicated in this. It's this institution. The other thing that divestment does that's really excellent is it provides an experiential education in organizing, and that's probably its most important and long-term effect. You know, it's one thing to say, okay, this is what happens. People in power say they agree with you, and then they stab you in the back. And, you know, so what? You say that. But the divestment movement, people experience that again and again on campus. They learn how to organize. They learn how to overcome their differences. You know, it's like, it's an incredible school for politics. So I support the movement completely with those criticisms. And to people who get upset about being criticized, I think that the left, the environmental movement, needs to really get over that. We're not going to innovate if there isn't room for a little bit of criticism here and there. But I completely support the divestment movement.
I thank you for your analysis, and I applaud my colleagues on campus for their, all over the United States, for their attempts at forcing disinvestment. But where are the rest of the people? Where are the people who are going to threaten the elite in order to move them into the direction that needs to be done, at least to, as you say, buy the time to provide us with?
They're all over the place, but they're unorganized. That's what I would say. I was just talking with some activists here in Chicago last night, and we all agreed that it seems like the left, broadly defined, progressive movements are much stronger now than they were 10 years ago. I mean, you know, got all this, like, you know, living wage stuff. Things are picking up. They're not where we would like them to be, but I mean, I think there are plenty of people who have grievances and have concerns that need to be met, and that social movements are really the answer for them, but they have to be reached with organizers, right? And that gets into the distinction that Fran Fox Piven makes between mobilizing and organizing. For a while there, the American left confused mobilizing and organizing. Organizing is the hard work that comes before. Mobilization are the flashpoints. And I think there are plenty of people to be organized. So you've got, you know, the living wage stuff, this anti-police brutality stuff. This is a very real organic movement that's pulling in people who were not previously politicized or active. So I think, you know, there are definitely good signs on the horizon.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I guess the one thing I would say is that also, you know, organized labor really, whenever I make criticisms of you know, movements, it's like I'm doing it out of a place of concern and solidarity. But, I mean, organized labor is facing a serious crisis with this attack at the state level, and that, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with that, but I think that the organized labor needs to really kind of return to roots and think in terms of movement building, not, you know, funding, you know, not dumping millions of dollars into recall campaigns of governors that aren't going to work. I mean, only three governors have ever been recalled. And this is the response. A buddy of mine worked for the UFCW in Michigan, trying to build workers' movement. And what was coming down from the union was like, you got to get more money out of the members because we have to, give money to the PAC to fund the recall campaign. And it's like, and if that doesn't work, what's the plan? That was the plan, and that's where all the money went. So that kind of thinking is got to stop, in my opinion. Yeah.
One of the things you said about the elites have sort of lost their vision about what they want. I think that one of the things that is an argument against that is that the media, which is owned by the elites in almost all cases, seems to march to the right fairly steadily. I mean, it's even gotten to the point where NPR is kind of a joke. I think the elites, they want more money because they sort of feel that when they're anxious, that's their only conception of protecting themselves and solving their problems. And so, I mean, if there was this diversity of thinking among these billionaires, I mean, you would think that Ross Perot's would be falling out of the, trees at this point. I mean, those guys are arrogant and there's plenty of people who could blow $1 billion and run for president,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, no, I agree with what you're saying. He doesn't quite say it in these terms, but it's sort of like this, can't quite quote it from volume 3 of Capital. It says, the capitalist is not concerned with the rate of surplus value, but with the mass, right? And that reveals a lot. It's not, capitalists aren't concerned with capitalism. They're concerned with getting as much money as possible right now. Not every individual capitalist, but like the logic of accumulation is not the logic of reproducing a system. It's the logic of maximizing the amount of money you have right now. And that is now the guiding ethos of our economic elites. And it's because they're not threatened. Their system isn't threatened. They're not looking at like, wow, one third of the planet is controlled by a system that doesn't let us invest there, doesn't let us own its oil companies, et cetera.
Thank you for coming, Dr. Parenti. I'm a second year in the college who's also part of the divestment campaign. We'll actually have petitions out back if anybody's interested. But my question isn't about divestment. My question is about the potential for a social movement in India, especially when considering the balances with coal-fired growth. And there may not be as much of a tension there as some people would like to suggest, but I'm wondering from the view of both people in the political elite in India and also people on the ground, how they see these two sort of factors intersecting.
Well, I went to India for the book, but what I was looking at was the Naxalite insurgency in Andhra Pradesh, and I did not really look into the question of mitigation in India and India's energy policy. I did talk with one of their top climate scientists, and his opinion was that the Indian elite, by and large, the policy elite, really didn't take climate change seriously until very, very recently. And I don't really know enough about what is going on in terms of Indian energy policy to speak thoroughly to your question. I did read recently, though, that the Tata Group was closing down coal plants, that there's some sign of moving away from large coal. There are, of course, these mining projects. There is the fact that India doesn't really have a very functional grid. So that opens the door for the kind of leapfrog technology of photovoltaics. And the price point is correct on that now. I mean, photovoltaics are really quite cheap. So, I don't know what to say about India. But I will say this about China, just in case that you're wondering. I mean, the good news about China and mitigation is that for the same reasons that we passed the Clean Air Act in the early 70s, so too are the Chinese building out renewable energy at a pretty fast pace. And it's not necessarily because of concern about climate change, but it's because of the air apocalypse. It's just that it's impossible to breathe in many Chinese cities. The air quality index here, if it gets up to 50, it goes from 1 to 100 generally. If it gets up to 50, you start getting warnings for people with compromised immune systems, et cetera, et cetera. In many Chinese cities all summer, it's above 500. It's up at 700. I mean, corporate elites, diplomats are refusing to take these posts and go to China. The Chinese elite are hating this. The Chinese working class hate it and are protesting. And it's in response to the local apocalypse that there's actually some real movement in terms of energy policy in China. So that is good news in terms of all developing countries because it helps lower the cost of these new technologies.
Hi there. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. I have two questions. I realize you may not have time to get to both. My first is, what role do you think market-based solutions like carbon taxes, cap and trade systems will have in solving climate change? And two, what advice do you have for students who want to help the cause of solving climate change? What advice do you have for careers, paths to follow? Thank you.
Well, my advice is, you know, keep on keeping on, think critically, and think about the state. Think big and think about the state. I really think we have to start demanding action from the EPA. And so I would also think that the role of institutional purchasing is very important, what I've called the big green buy, and that institutions can be forced to become much cleaner than they are. A lot of these universities could source all their power from renewable energy. I don't know what the laws in Illinois are, but I know in New York, you know, you pay a 15% premium and you get energy from, you know, wind or solar. I mean, of course, you get energy, whatever. The electrons are the electrons. I mean, my energy comes from Indian Point nuclear power plant, probably. But I pay money, pay the 15 extra percent, and that goes to Green Mountain Power that has wind farms that feed into Con Ed. So the laws and the infrastructure is in place to force big institutions to start really, you know, consuming clean energy and also to act as markets for clean technology in other ways. So that there must be some way that the investment can work into that. I mean, as the victories build, then I think these questions also will become front and center for students. It's like, okay, so then what happens when the schools do divest? What's next? In terms of market-based solutions, carbon taxes are not a market-based solution. That's the opposite of a market-based solution. That's the government saying, if you do this, we're going to tax you. That's not the market coming up with some mechanism for pricing. That's the state intervening saying, you know, this is, you know, we're going to discourage this by making it more expensive. So I think that's really important. And I think that there is a role for private investment, for private firms, for innovation to build out the new technology, et cetera, et cetera. But it's only going to happen if the state sets the game, the rules of the game, such that it will, that there's a need for that to happen and that it's profitable for that to happen, right? What we need to do is get close the price gap between clean energy and dirty energy, and that's happening. So electric vehicles, right? The federal government has a, you know, huge fleet of electric vehicles, not even just, never mind the military. The post office alone has like 118,000 vehicles, I think it is, most of which, 140,000 vehicles, most of which travel 18 miles a day and park in the same place every night. There's absolutely no reason they shouldn't be, like, the fleet for the post office shouldn't be like 90 to 95% electric. If that happened, the producers of electric vehicles would be able to sell them on the open market at a lower price, to the point where you could imagine your local beer distributor or soda distributor, they're thinking about what kind of vehicles to buy, and it's like, hey, if the electric vehicles are cheaper and we basically just drive in a circle every day and then park in the yard all night, why don't we do this, right? And right now they don't do that because it's like, one, the technology doesn't seem, you know, people are unclear how long it's going to be around, and also it's more expensive and there's these complicated subsidies programs. It's like, you know, but if the price gap closes, then I think that, you know, market mechanisms, as it were, will take over. That firms will buy clean energy, will buy electric vehicles when it's cheaper. So I hope that makes sense in terms of, to be clear, I do not put any credence in like proper market mechanisms. I have, as a Marxist, I have considerable faith in and respect for capitalism's powers to innovate and accumulate and produce wealth. I do not have faith in these kind of ideologically driven fantasies like the carbon markets. I mean, none of them work. The European carbon market, it's basically totally collapsed because there's no reason to participate. The operative word in cap and trade is cap. If you don't have the state, that's the state role. If the state isn't in there controlling things, saying you must reduce your carbon footprint, then why would you go buy offsets or why would you do any of this stuff? So markets require the state to build them. I think I should probably...
One more?
Yeah, take...
The chaos you described in the ruling class, can you address how it is stimulating the crisis in Ukraine and the likelihood of a nuclear war that quite a few people seem to be concerned with?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there was a gentleman's agreement at the end of the Cold War between George Bush Sr. and Gorbachev that NATO would not push up to the, you know, too far into the old Soviet sphere of influence. That was ignored by Clinton, and the reaction of Russia is, you know, the reaction to that. Russia feels threatened, regardless of what we think of Russia, regardless of what one thinks of Russia. I mean, that they feel threatened when a former part of the Soviet Union, Ukraine, wants to join the EU. And this is not a surprise, right? And this was understood at the end of the Cold War. And it was the United States government that really rewrote those rules. And doing stuff like investing $5 billion in democracy promotion in the Ukraine helps destabilize it. So that's not to say, oh, Putin is a great guy, and, oh, you know, the Russian rebels are, you know, wonderful. But, like, yeah, what do you expect, right? How is this a surprise? It's not a surprise at all. And another example is, I mean, look at what's happening to Greece. I mean, they seem to be like the finance ministers, the sadomonetarist finance ministers of, you know, Northern Europe seem pretty ready to let Greece maybe become a failed state. I mean, their whole thing is they're going to punish Greece. So that kind of that all of that is born out of a kind of hubris that's a post-Cold War hubris that, like, there are no limits. We don't have to worry about consequences. So, yes, I think it's an example of that kind of dangerous brinksmanship. As a child of the Cold War, I can't imagine an atomic war. I was never one of those kids in the 80s. There were sort of like two kinds of teenagers in the 80s. Those who knew there was going to be atomic war soon, and those who were like, I just can't see a bunch of, like, you know, like the leadership of the USSR or now Russia and the US essentially both committing suicide simultaneously. So I'm actually not that afraid of atomic war. I just don't think they're that irrational, though there's the risk of mistakes. Thank you very much for coming out. There's books over there. I'll sign them if you want. Thanks a lot.